record.
It's disturbing being in a sense of kind of surveillance. That I know. Tom
Rooney's well, what you have to do is imagine now that the part-timers sitting at home and say hello to them.
Okay. Hello, part-timers.
Hello.
They never say hello back again.
No, I've started already. It's okay. It's okay. Now, what I'm paranoid about is the idea that all of this goes straight to sort of Jeff Whitty's office or something, you know, goes straight to the management and they're checking up on our teaching.
They are. They're analysing it.
Probably, yeah. Probably. Okay, so, good afternoon. Andrew's given me this slightly difficult task. I eventually got my head around it, but trying really to go back over some of the stuff that you've done on the course this term and think about what education might have to do with it. As you know, we're sitting here in an Institute of Education, so it's not an unreasonable question. What's education got to do with it? And particularly, I guess, I would say education in schools. So what I'm going to do, this will be a little bit interactive. I am going to talk a lot, but at various points there will be some things for you to read and talk about. Feels like there's a sort of vast gap between me and you, and anyway. Hello. That's all right. So, okay, what I'm going to do is talk a little bit about history. So I'm going to talk about where we've been, and three moments really in this history, and then I'm going to come up to the present and talk about where we are now, and I'm going to talk about two sort of current debates, current issues really, that are particularly significant for us in our research and our thinking about education and media. So firstly, just to say a little bit about the kind of difficulty of this, really. I mean, if you look at books about cultural studies and media studies, you will find very little mention of education at all. I would say education as an issue is conspicuous by its absence, really. If you look at the work of the Birmingham Centre, which you will have done a little bit earlier this term, the Birmingham Centre for Contemporary Cultural Studies, really the key organisation in cultural studies in the UK. There was a book actually published at the beginning of the 1980s called Unpopular Education, which was really a kind of analysis of education policy. But aside from that, very little discussion of education at all. When you look at the work about youth culture that was done at the Birmingham Centre in the 1970s, you get a bit of a sense of education there, but largely education is the other. So, for example, Paul Willis's book, Learning to Labour, which is one of the key studies of youth culture in the late 1970s, and if you've come across this, it's basically an ethnography. He spends a lot of time hanging out with kids in and around a school. And he makes this distinction between these two groups of kids, whom he calls the lads and the year-olds. And the lads are basically the young people, boys, who are resisting school. And Paul Willis, the academic, clearly identifies with the lads. The year-olds are the conformists. They're the people who kind of do what the teacher tells them. And they're profoundly uncool, basically. And so what you get is this story of youth culture, very much identified with the school resistors, and a sense that what goes on in school is all about discipline and conformity, and that's the end of the story, really. So a bit of a sense there that, you know, youth culture, insofar as we study youth culture, school is just not really a significant place where youth culture happens. I think one other thing that if you've looked at in books about cultural studies, if you've looked for mention of education, what you will find is some of this stuff called critical pedagogy. The key people in this would be Henry Giroux, somebody who I always want to call Malcolm McLaren, but he was the manager of the Sex Pistols. Peter McLaren, who are, you know, producing these books about you know, sort of radical perspectives on education. It's quite a sort of rant, really, about what teachers ought to be doing. But it's something that, in my view, fails really to talk about education, actually. There's a lot of theory and a lot of rhetoric about how education can change the world, but very little recognition of the realities of what goes on in schools and classrooms. So I think it's fair to say that if you look at cultural studies, you would find that education as a concern is pretty absent. On the other hand, you do have people arguing very much that cultural studies, in particular, was a kind of radical intervention in education, albeit an intervention that really only happened at the level of the university. So when you look at some of the early work in cultural studies in the UK, if you look to the founding fathers, you know, Raymond Williams, Richard Hoggart, E.P. Thompson, these people beginning to emerge in the late 1950s, it's really interesting that many of them, all those three, worked in adult education. They worked in what used to be called the extramural departments of universities, i.e. the departments of universities that reached out to ordinary people, and particularly working class people. So you had a sense for those people, for the founding fathers of cultural studies, that this was a kind of educational intervention. And there was a sense that what cultural studies was doing was bringing popular culture into the university, bringing working class experience into the university, and that this was a kind of challenging thing to be doing. And along with that, also an argument that cultural studies crossed disciplinary boundaries. It was politically challenging to the ways in which knowledge was defined at the university. So some people arguing, I think in a rather sort of grandiose way, that cultural studies is all about political struggle. It's all about sort of contesting and challenging elitism. And then the argument goes, cultural studies has been gradually institutionalised. The argument is that as cultural studies has moved from, you know, the 1950s, 1960s, where it was really sort of out on the margins, as it's gradually kind of come into the mainstream of education, it's been turned into a discipline. It's been turned into a subject like any other subject. It's got its own set of canonized texts. It's got its readers, like the storybook that you've looked at. You know, it's become a lucrative money spinner for academic publishers and so on. It's just become a subject like any other subject. Various people have complained about this. It's quite a nice essay, actually, by Raymond Williams, and another essay by Stuart Hall, you know, the kind of old geezers, really, kind of looking at cultural studies and what's become of cultural studies. And there's a sense that they see it as having sort of lost its youthful, radical edge that it had in the 1960s. And it's just become like anything else in universities. Now, I don't know, there's a danger of a bit of a sort of romantic myth about all of this, you know, the idea that cultural studies used to be radical and it was engaged in this kind of heroic struggle and, you know, eventually it was kind of bought off by the establishment. And you can actually trace, interestingly, similar things going on with other new subjects. I mean, if you look at across the 20th century, you can look at the history of English as a subject, or you can look at psychology as a subject, or sociology these are all invented in the course of the 20th century as subjects, and you can see a gradual process of them becoming kind of institutionalized and becoming part of mainstream higher education. And whether that's all about, you know, them losing their radicalism, I'm a bit more doubtful. What I put on the slide, and don't copy this down, but the slides will be on Blackboard, but it's quite a nice article here which kind of goes back over some of this history if you're interested, and really tries to sort of puncture some of the myth. Okay, what I do want to do is to talk a bit about the history, and particularly the history in terms of schools, really. What I've been talking about so far is really about universities. So I want to talk about schools and talk about three moments in this history, and thinking really about what media studies, cultural studies might look like as it gets taught to students in schools. So here we have F.R. Leavis and Dennis Thompson writing in 1933. So I was thinking this book was actually published 75 years ago. I went and got it from the library, actually, because I wanted to find some stuff for you, which we'll look at in a minute. Here it is. It's almost falling apart. I'm not sure if this is the first edition. Actually, no, it's not. This is the fourth impression from 1942. So this was, you know, in its moment, first published 1933, a book that was then republished many times. So obviously a very influential book. Here's a quote which kind of defines the approach here. We cannot, as we might in a healthy state of culture, leave the citizen to be formed by his environment. If anything like a worthwhile idea of satisfactory living is to be saved, he must be trained to discriminate and resist. Right, so the argument here is that basically, you know, popular culture, mass culture, media is a problem. And what we need to be doing in education is teaching young people to discriminate and resist. Now, I'm going to say a little bit to sort of set this approach in context and say a little bit about what it means. And as you'll see, QuickTime and a TIFF uncompressed decompressor are needed to see this picture.
It's a Mac PC thing.
So if we had proper computers in here, this wouldn't happen. Okay, so let me put this in context. There was going to be a picture of Frankie, of F.R. Leavis.
I've got one in
there.
Now.
Okay, there you are. So, I mean, important, I think, to put this argument, 1933, in its context. And some of this you'll have done. You've had a bit of a look at Raymond Williams' Culture and Society. Yes, I mean, Leavis really is part of that tradition, which goes back a very long way. In fact, really, I would say goes back to the Romantics, the Romantic poets, goes back to Matthew Arnold in the 19th century. Matthew Arnold, interestingly, was also a school head teacher. And Matthew Arnold's book, Culture and Anarchy, published in 1869, so we're in serious history here. And Matthew Arnold's argument was that you know, civilization was at risk of collapsing into anarchy. And his argument was that what we needed to do was to use culture, great art, as a means of sort of salvation, that great art was the thing that was going to save society from collapsing into anarchy. And you can find that sort of argument going on as you come, you know, through the 19th century into the 20th century. So T.S. Eliot, D.H. Lawrence, and also, I think, interestingly, in a different way, in Europe, the Frankfurt School, Adorno, for example, that sort of argument, in a way you can see is the same kind of response to an industrialised mass society. So what you have is this long-running concern really about the effects of industrialisation. And for Leavis in particular, this was about how industrialisation had destroyed a rural way of life, what he calls the organic community. So somehow there was a sense that somewhere back in the day, you know, people used to live an authentic way of life, and mass culture, industrialisation has come along and destroyed that way of life. And the way to get back to that is through art and culture, through great literature. And that was really particularly Leavis's project. So Leavis in the 1920s and 1930s engaged in, at the time, what you could see as a kind of radical struggle. I mean, he was basically a literary critic, but his argument was about the need for English literary study, the study of English literature as a means of sustaining civilization, sustaining a set of sort of healthy moral and cultural values. Yeah, if you go back to that quote, it talks about we cannot, as we might in a healthy state of culture, leave the citizen to be formed by his environment. If anything like a worthwhile idea of satisfactory living is to be saved, the citizen needs to discriminate and resist. So this idea that somehow, you know, we're not in a healthy state of culture, that we're all going to hell, basically, and what we need is art and culture. And for him, that was about the discipline of English. And interestingly, you know, there was a struggle that went on, because at that point, at the point in the 1920s, actually the discipline that really was about doing that was classics. You know, that students in universities would be studying ancient Greek and Latin. And one of the arguments going on there was about English literature doing some of the civilising things that classics were supposed to do. So for Leavis, it was about establishing English as a discipline. But when you look then at how this idea gets carried into schools, what you have is the argument that we can't just be showing students great literature and great art. What we also need to be doing is engaging with the stuff that, unfortunately, you know, they are so interested in, i.e. popular culture. So the danger is that outside school, kids are you know, watching these trashy films, they're consuming advertising, they're reading trashy novels. And so what we need to do is we need to sort of carry the struggle into you know, the culture that they're actually engaging with. So Dennis Thompson's work, and Dennis Thompson was a student of F.R. Leavis, and they wrote this book together, which is really a kind of textbook for schools. It's written for teachers. And the argument is very much that popular culture is kind of cheap, it's dishonest, it's false. To some extent, obviously, they're not way before television. They're talking about film, they're talking about advertising, they're talking about popular literature, or what they call railway fiction, which what we now, I guess, would call airport novels, right? You know, it's the kind of cheap, nasty, tacky things that you would pick up at a railway station. And in fact, Leavis's wife, who implausibly enough is called Queenie Leavis. Have you done some of this? Queenie wrote a whole... Oh, Queenie is worth checking out. Queenie wrote a book called Popular Fiction and the Reading Public, which carries this kind of argument into an analysis of this sort of, you know, railway fiction. So the aim then is about teaching students to discriminate and resist. So what you're doing when you teach about popular culture is to teach young people to see through the superficial, the instant gratification of popular culture, to see it as all about commercial manipulation. And then if they see through what's wrong with all of that stuff, then they will inevitably be led on to great literature. So there's a sense here of an enormous sort of crusade going on, really. In fact, at one point in this book, they talk about the struggle that they're engaged with as being a struggle against, quote, the whole world outside the classroom. Right, so there's this idea that the classroom is this is about the only place where young people are going to encounter authentic culture. And outside the classroom, it's just a cultural wasteland. So the aim of teaching about popular culture then is really one of inoculation. We'll look at a little bit of it, we'll give people a little dose of it, and then they'll be inoculated against it. And I think interesting, what I'm going to get you to look at in a minute is a little instance of how they went about this. I mean, this book has got a series of classroom exercises about journalism and advertising, and it asks students some questions about these. It's since emerged that some of the examples of advertising in the book actually were made up. But it's quite striking how confident they are about the fact that this technique is actually going to work, that once kids see through all of this trash, that they'll realise the superiority of great literature. They'll be won over to the cause, to this crusade. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to give you a little chunk. It's just four short pages from this book, and I'm going to ask you three questions about it. So what I want you to think about is, firstly, they're giving a series of questions. They're almost like essay questions, really. And I want you to think, firstly, about what's the aim of it? You know, what's the point of it? What are they trying to do? Secondly, what do they assume that students, the young people they're teaching, already know about this stuff? You know, what existing knowledge do they have of these media, whether it's advertising or anything else? I think most of this stuff actually is about advertising. And then the third question is about the pedagogy. So how is it attempting to teach them? Okay? So what I want to do is just get you, if you can...
I'll turn this off.
Sorry?
I'll turn this off.
Oh, yeah. Okay. If you'd like to take one...